Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service, where we report the world, however difficult the issue, however hard to reach. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Leute, es wird unangenehm, denn ich muss euch einfach fragen, habt ihr euch eigentlich schon mal um eure Versicherung gekümmert? Hier ist übrigens Tara vom Podcast Tara sagt was und ich sage euch, es wird allerhöchste Zeit, Ordnung in euer Versicherungschaos zu bringen und dabei kann euch die App Clark helfen. Da arbeiten ganz viele Expertinnen, die das hauptberuflich machen, man glaubt es kaum. Und mit meinem Code TARA60, alles groß und zusammengeschrieben, könnt ihr euch sogar einen Shopping-Gutschein sichern, 60 Euro, bei zum Beispiel Amazon oder Douglas einlösbar, mit dem Code TARA60.
I'm Katya Adler from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at the tiny country of Guyana, which is the fastest growing economy in the world. But will newfound oil reserves be a windfall or their downfall? Curious? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
The Global Jigsaw is the podcast lifting the language barrier to show you the world through its media.
Radio Tehran.
Мы не вторгались на территорию Украины.
Western countries are not the international community. That era has finished.
The Global Jigsaw from the BBC World Service. Listen now by searching for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
For as long as I can remember, I've wanted to go back home, to Rwanda, home to the place where I was born, a home I hadn't seen in 30 years.
Well, hello, hello, ladies. Thank you, guys. Well, here we are. I'm finally going home, guys.
I know. That's not, you were supposed to wait for us, you know?
I'm Victoria Uwonhunda from the BBC World Service with the documentary Rwanda 30 Years On. In the next hour, I'll be exploring personal journeys, my own returning to Rwanda, and the deep and emotional stories of those who had a role in the killings in the 1994 genocide and their survivors. This day had been long in the making.
Okay, there goes the suitcase. We are zipping in and we are ready to go.
I fled the Rwandan genocide as a child, on the cusp of teenagehood. Here I was, returning as a woman. I now live in the UK and I am a journalist with the BBC.
Hello and welcome to Newsday on the BBC World Service with Rob Young and Victoria Uwonhunda.
30 years on, how does a country and its people heal from a genocide? What mark does that leave on survivors, perpetrators, and future generations?
Here we go. Off to Terminal 3, Heathrow, London. Next time I see the outside of an airport will be in my own home country, Rwanda, which I have not seen in a very long time, but here we are.
I was emotional when I got on the plane. Welcoming me on board was a song I remembered from my childhood. A song that quickly took me back to a long and desolate day, April 12th, 1994, when I left my birth city of Kigali under a blanket of bullets in search of a safe haven as nothing but death seemed to be all around us. The song, which among other things talks about suffering in silence, struck a chord with me, particularly the line about not knowing how much hunger hurt until it happened to you. My, oh my, how do I relate? That day, we stopped one place after another, desperately looking for anything to eat or drink, but found empty shelves. I had never known what hunger or thirst felt like. Funny how such small things, like a song, can take you back to a particular time. A moment in time, two of my sisters, Danila Temeros and Nelly Mukamurenzi, reminded me of when we caught up briefly before I left for Rwanda.
I remember when we stopped for food after so many hours in the car, and there was literally nothing because everything was finished. And for me, that always sticks in my memory of that day when we were leaving Kigali. So I wonder, what memories do you have, guys, for that?
You and I were in the trunk.
Yes, we were. The smaller ones, yeah.
I wasn't looking out. You remember, because we were sitting in the back and we couldn't really see much outside. I think we stopped somewhere and somebody gave us some bread and water. And that was the only thing we ate in that day, or even like the first water we had. And I know it was a really long journey, but for me, like, it's so compressed into this kind of really uncomfortable, hungry, thirsty, warm, scary emotion that ended when we arrived, you know, at our grandparents' home in Mutura. And I remember getting out of the car. Like, that's the thing that I remember, just getting out of the car, and Dad was there. And we were somewhere that I considered home, so somewhere familiar. And so it was almost like taking in a big breath after holding it for hours.
Ladies and gentlemen, we come at Kigali International Airport, where the local time is now 6:07 a.m. and the outside temperature has been reported as...
I had been yearning to see this place again after so many years. But as much as I'd been so excited to come back home, I also knew there would be things I couldn't shy away from. The sights, sounds, smells that might not quite fit the ones I had from my childhood. And the unknown, the big elephant in this story, the emotions, feelings. Despite all of this, I still looked forward to everything. New and old connections, rediscovering the place that held such a warm and special place in my heart.
Yeah. Hello. Was somebody here waiting for me?
As I got off the plane, it wasn't lost on me that this was the first time I had ever landed at Kigali Airport.
Lovely to meet you in real life.
Thank you very much. First time I've been.
I'd visited many times to see off and welcome family and friends, but I had never set foot outside on the tarmac.
How does it feel? Well, not empty. Empty is not a word, but I felt a bit underwhelmed. I built this up. I was excited. I'm still excited, but it hasn't really sunk in, I guess.
I may not have been struck by the big emotion straight away, but when I realized everyone around me spoke my mother tongue, the elusive emotions hit me, and it dawned on me. I hadn't been in a place where everyone spoke my language in so long. I was home. This is the place, just on the outskirts of Kigali, that was the scene of the plane crash that had been carrying the then president of Rwanda.
Gunfire and explosions are continuing in Kigali, the capital of Rwanda, following the death of President Juvenal Habyarimana. He was killed in a plane crash yesterday, along with President Cyprien and Tariamira of neighbouring Burundi.
A moment in time said to have been the ignition of the 1994 genocide.
This morning, three prominent government ministers opposed to the late president have been kidnapped.
The plane was coming from Arusha in Tanzania, where there had been extensive peace negotiations that had been ongoing since the outbreak of the civil war in 1990.
Dr. Nicola Palmer is reader in criminal law at King's College London.
President Juvenal Habyarimana was on the plane along with the president of Burundi and a range of other officials who were flying back from those peace negotiations.
I vividly remember that night. We'd been sitting down at the dinner table the night before we were meant to return to school after Easter holidays. From the second it was known the plane had been shot down, a cacophony of gunfire and bombs started. And from that moment on, life would never be the same for every Rwandan. About 85% of Rwandans are Hutus, but the Tutsi minority had long dominated the country. In 1959, the Hutus overthrew the Tutsi monarchy, and amongst the violence and killings, tens of thousands of Tutsis fled to neighboring countries, including Uganda. A group of Tutsi exiles formed a rebel group, the Rwandan Patriotic Front, the RPF, which invaded Rwanda in 1990, and fighting continued until a 1993 peace deal was agreed. But that plane crash on the 6th of April 1994 signaled the end of that peace.
The plane crash is the curtain raiser to widespread violence and direct targeting of Tutsi civilians, where what we saw in the immediate aftermath of it was that the military moves to establish control of the Rwandan state, and we start to see roadblocks being set up which stop and interrogate and then kill Tutsi civilians. We also see the direct assassination of the Prime Minister and a number of other individuals who are directly targeted.
Hutu extremists blamed the RPF and immediately started an organized campaign of slaughter. ID cards for all Rwandans had been introduced by the Belgian colonial government in 1933. It introduced a rigid racial concept of group identity.
So the ID cards become a quick mechanism through which individuals were identified to be killed. So when roadblocks were set up and Tutsi civilians were being targeted, as they had been categorized as Nyanzi, as cockroaches, and had been subject to years of explicit dehumanization, the ID card becomes a mechanism through which to quickly identify who is or is not a Tutsi. And so holding that identity card became, for many, a death sentence.
The killing was encouraged by the authorities at the time, even through newspapers and radio broadcasts. Neighbors killed neighbors, and some husbands even killed their Tutsi wives.
Evidence is emerging that thousands of people have been killed and thousands more injured in 2 days of fighting in the Central African state of Rwanda.
Rwanda's killing is a neighborly genocide, a crime of mass complicity on a scale unknown in Africa.
In just 100 days, about 800,000 people were killed.
Every day in Rwanda, they're digging more mass graves, but there'll never be room for all the dead after a month of genocidal slaughter.
Human rights groups say RPF fighters killed thousands of Hutu civilians as they took back power, and more after they went into the Democratic Republic of Congo to pursue the Interahamwe militia. The RPF denies this. The Rwandan government has said some elements of the RPA, the Rwandan Patriotic Army, after returning home and finding their families massacred, wanted revenge, and there were some killings. They also say that any RPA soldier accused of any killings was brought to justice and punished. As the violence got worse, we moved around Kigali trying to find a safe place for days. When we could no longer find a sanctuary, decision was made to leave Kigali. With my mom, my 5 siblings, and some other family and friends, all bundled into our car, we slowly made our way to our family in Gisenyi in the northwest of Rwanda, now called Rubavu District. I never saw Kigali again. 3 months later, I'd cross into the Democratic Republic of Congo, becoming a refugee, before we made our way to Kenya, which became our home for the next 3 years. Eventually, the United Nations rehomed our family in Norway. I am now a journalist with the BBC in the UK.
Kigali is truly a changed city. Everywhere you look, tall buildings rising high up above the horizon and the skyline, and those rolling hills of Kigali, which I used to skip down when I was coming from school or running just to go see a friend in the neighborhood. It's good to be home. It's good to be able to walk around and see and hear and know that we have this one thing in common. We have the language, we have the culture, we have the history. And that is what I'm looking forward to, the stories that I will bring you, the stories that people will share with us, but my own story too, because I am part of that story, I am part of that history, and I'm ready to go. So we are almost at our destination. We've been driving for a couple of hours from Kigali. We are now in the center of the country, and we are here to meet a set of special people. We are here to meet a group of perpetrators and survivors, and they're brought together by one Christian organization that has used cows, which are quite integral to our culture, to the Rwandan people. And the reason for that is to help find ways that you can bring together people who were victimized with their offenders to build, to find peace, to find healing, and to find a reconciliation after the genocide of 1994.
And one of the people we met was Evariste Sibomana. He was in the field just below his neat home. He was with a group of his neighbors. They'd come to help him and his family plant green beans. This group takes turns supporting one another like this. But this isn't any regular group of neighbors or people gathering on a sunny mid-morning in central Rwanda. This is a group of perpetrators and their victims and survivors of the genocide. You see, Evariste is a killer. At the age of 24, he killed a neighbor, a family friend. His story is distressing to hear.
We attacked from the other side of the road, and we infiltrated the crowd so that we could take them by surprise. Some were taken to other places, and we stayed here with others, including Narcisse's mother. I was offered a cow if I accepted to kill her, and as a young man, I didn't hesitate. I killed her.
And in this group, listening also is Narcisse Rwamucyo. There is a reason he is here too. The person Evariste is describing killing was Narcisse's mother.
When the genocide stopped, I had lost my parents and my siblings, and especially because Evariste was the only perpetrator close to me. I mean close to me as a neighbor, not as a friend. I could see him more often than others. Therefore, I thought he was the one who exterminated my family. To me, he was not only a murderer, as he said, but a monster.
Evariste went through the traditional Rwandan justice system, Gacaca courts, local community hearings, and was sentenced to 18 years. Now, Evariste and Narcisse have been brought together by a local Christian organization, CARSA, to heal and seek and be granted forgiveness.
I was able to approach Narcisse and ask him for forgiveness. I asked him if he could accept my request and help me. I told him that I wanted to ask for forgiveness and begged him to assist me in the process if I failed. So I told him every single detail about his mother's killing from start to end. He said, "Okay, I forgive you. And now it's my turn to express my apology because I saw you as a monster. I got stuck at some point, but because I had prepared him, he touched my hand to reassure me. We had also said a prayer before, so he assisted me all the way until I completed my journey and we closed the healing session with a prayer and moved on as friends.
So he came to my home and told me he wanted to apologize for killing my mother and provide me with first-hand information about the incident. After that, I told him, "Do not feel the burden anymore. I forgive you from the deep of my heart."
Before I could go and ask for forgiveness, I used to stay away from all survivors, and I was very ashamed to go in public. But I am better off now. I even socialize with many survivors.
So when we talk about individual trauma, we are describing a clinical condition. It's post-traumatic stress disorder. It affects everyone who has been a participant in violent events, whether as a victim or as a perpetrator.
Dr. Alexandros Lordos is an assistant professor of clinical psychology and a specialist in resilience of conflict-affected populations.
There is also perpetrator trauma, which is a type of moral injury that perpetrators experience around the guilt of what they have done. But of course, there is the trauma of the survivor, which is linked with fear that they may be victimized again. It is linked with the violation of trust and faith in humanity and faith in people in the community. And then there is the collective trauma, which is the wound that the whole community experiences, especially in a setting where the violence was so intimate, where neighbors attacked neighbors and family members attacked family members. So there is a sense of not knowing who can be trusted anymore, a sense of grasping to rediscover what is the meaning of communal existence.
People who killed during the 1994 genocide in Rwanda are brought together with their victims or their families, and the hope is that both look after a cow together. Christopher Mbonyingabo is the man behind this project.
So when we give them the cow, it's shared by both. They raise the cow together as a way of creating a bridge to allow their process of forgiveness and reconciliation to be sustainable, but also because it's a journey, when they meet to feed the cow, to clean the cow, to raise the cow together, it allows them to dig more deeper into their process of forgiveness and repentance and reconciliation. So cow is an important aspect in the Rwandan culture because it's a sign of wealth and dignity and value in the community. It's something that's bound people together. In the Rwandan culture, when you give, it's the highest gift you give to someone you love. So that's how we've thought about the cow, and that's the uniqueness of it because it has those different aspects and contributes. As was used to divide the Rwanda, now we are using that to reconnect.
Well, the cows are still with me, as you may hear in the background. I just finished what feels like 500 of the 1,000 hills that Rwanda is known for. It's been a wonderful day, but also very powerful. We've had stories from the people, the stories that we want to bring you, the stories of what people have been through, of what happened 30 years ago. And it is actually the first time that I can remember or that I know of that I've come face to face with somebody who's admitted that they killed or took another person's life. It was very powerful. It was all a story about how you go from that, from committing those atrocities, and the power of forgiveness, of healing, of finding it within yourself to look the man who took your mother's life away in the eye and say, "I forgive you."
I'm Victoria Uwonghunda, and from the BBC World Service, this is the documentary, Rwanda 30 Years On.
We
water used as a weapon of war.
In none of these villages there was any piped clean water for people.
A nation in the grip of criminal gangs.
How bad does it have to get before the international community reacts?
A country showing signs of fracture.
Right now with Sudan, things are really quite dark. The nation is divided. The mistrust runs so deep.
The Global Jigsaw from the BBC World Service is back for a new series. Listen now by searching for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
I'm Victoria Uwonghunda. You are listening to the BBC World Service documentary, Rwanda 30 Years On. I have returned to Rwanda, my home, for the first time since 1994.
Evidence is emerging that thousands of people have been killed and thousands more injured in 2 days of fighting in the Central African state of Rwanda.
Rwanda's killing is a neighbourly genocide, a crime of mass complicity on a scale unknown in Africa.
I fled the Rwandan genocide as a child, on the cusp of teenagehood. Here I was, returning as a woman. I now live in the UK and I am a journalist with the BBC.
This is my personal story, and also the story of those whose lives were impacted by division and violence. I'm on a journey to see how Rwanda has changed, a journey into reconciliation, forgiveness, and healing.
All right, so we have now just passed the sign welcoming us to Rubavu district, which when I last crossed the border into this very same area, it was called Gisenyi. Many names have changed, but the places remain. So we're actually less than 10 minutes away from my homestead, the last place that I was before we left Rwanda in 1994, just headed to see family, cousins. We are arriving very shortly, very soon, when I get to hug the people that I haven't seen in 30 years. So I'm excited and I look forward to this.
Part of Rwanda's healing and reconciliation is my own. And here I was returning and meeting relatives, alas so, when we were skinny, scrawny kids, running in the fields from morning till dark, happily playing and getting dirty. I had longed to see my cousin Augusta and family again. We'd last seen each other before we all fled into the Democratic Republic of Congo, then known as Zaire, after making the journey from Kigali when the violence had broken out.
I was 12. Augusta was 10.
But for 3 quiet and peaceful months before crossing the border, we'd stayed with relatives in Gisenyi, including Augusta. We had been safe for a while. But the violence quickly spread and we all had to leave in fear of our lives.
Relief workers in Zaire say 500,000 refugees have now crossed from Rwanda into the border town of Goma, and they predict that many more people will follow.
We were having dinner here, and all of a sudden we heard heavy footsteps from that path behind the house which used to be here before, behind those buildings. We heard a lot of people fleeing, and when we went out to check, we saw they were civilians passing through these small side roads, not the main road. We immediately joined them. I remember I was wearing this one pair of shorts, which I had on for a long time while in the Democratic Republic of Congo. I got separated from my parents because I fled to the DRC through the countryside while they went through Gisenyi town and into Goma.
My immediate family and I ended up in Goma in the east of the DRC. Augustin took another route. But because of the sheer number of us fleeing into the DRC, we never saw each other again.
I left with the neighbors.
I told them I didn't know where my parents had gone. So I went with them until we crossed the border through Kabuhanga, while my parents fled to Goma via La Grande Barrière, which is the main border. My parents were in Goma and I was in the Kibumba camp, whereas refugees, we stayed for about 2 years. In those first days, life in the refugee camp was very bad. There was a cholera outbreak because of poor hygiene and lack of proper nutrition, and people got sick. Thousands of people died from it. I got it too.
After a while, Augustin reunited with his parents and eventually they all returned to Rwanda. But there was so much to rebuild, so many wounds, physical and emotional.
We have been collecting data over the past few years in Bugesera district, which is just south of Kigali, and it was one of the areas that was hardest hit during the genocide.
Dr. Alexandros Lordos is an assistant professor of clinical psychology and a specialist in resilience of conflict-affected populations.
Children who were born to survivors. And the stories that they tell us are of being home and bearing the burden of the silence of their parent because the parent feels that they cannot talk about what happened. Or if it's not the silence, it's narratives, it's hostile narratives or despair-inducing narratives about the history of the country and about the prospects of the country. That's where you get the intersection, not only between individual trauma and the collective historical trauma, but also the intergenerational trauma. We know, for instance, that children of survivors are 5 times more likely to experience post-traumatic stress disorder as children in the general population.
I could have stayed longer and talked with my family and seen more of the place I called home, my safe haven for 3 months during the genocide. But I knew there was another place I needed to go see before this part of my journey came to an end. For now. Next stop was a 20-minute or so drive to the city towards the border with the Democratic Republic of Congo. The last place I was when I left my home country 30 years ago. Standing on the sandy stretch of beach at Lake Kivu, the idyllic city looks as divine as I've always remembered it. As the water laps at the shores, I take it all in. On my left are the green hills. Yes, the hills are here too. On one side is Rwanda, separated by a body of water, Lake Kivu. And on the right side, further down, I can clearly see neighboring DRC. Looking around, I'm brought back to that July day in 1994 when I stepped over the border, walked into another country, effectively taking me from being an internally displaced person, or IDP, to a refugee. 30 years and the memories are still alive. Sometimes I feel lucky. My family and I escaped, but many didn't. On my way from Rubavu and high from meeting my cousin and family, I was thinking of my next visit. I'd arranged to meet with 2 people who'd also been a part of a reconciliation project through their local church in Nyamata, just outside of Kigali. A place where some of the worst atrocities were committed. An area that saw earlier killings take place already in 1992.
I wasn't the only one in my family who survived. It's me, our second born, and the seventh born. 11 other siblings were killed. When I talk about the genocide against Tutsi, I recount my whole testimony. I first experienced genocide in 1992, when my family was exterminated. That is when my brother, along with his 7 children, were killed.
One of the people who survived both rounds of killings is Claudette Mukarumanzi. She is a very vivacious and tall woman. She greeted me with a wide, white smile and kind face, with quiet laughter behind her sparkly eyes. a contrast to the story she was about to share, which many might find distressing.
He ordered me to lie down on my stomach. I was thinking that he will whip me with a stick, as he had a stick and a spear in his hands. He stabbed my back with a spear. I still have the scars today. He stabbed me fiercely and left me thinking it had gone through me to the ground. I wondered who would save me. After a while, I reached back and removed the spear and threw it away. I then headed to the church where others had sought refuge.
That church was Nyamata Catholic Church in Bugesera, not far from Kigali, where people were taking sanctuary.
They came slashing people, starting with the parents, the adults who were at the entrance. I remember an elderly woman who was my neighbor. She was targeted first. She put her hands up and they slashed her immediately. They kept on cutting through the people until they found me. In another doorway, they were using guns, shooting. They couldn't open the door. They struggled because there were so many dead bodies in front of that door. I said to myself, let me see who is coming to kill me. And I see this man. He came and stood inside the church. Then he lacerated me. He was singing when he was cutting me. He slashed me in the face and blood was running down my face.
Hundreds were killed inside that church. It's now a national memorial to the genocide. Claudette managed to escape. She ran from the church and hid in a neighbor's house. But she was soon discovered, and on top of the wounds she had already suffered, she was shot. She was 13.
Listening in as Claudette was speaking was a man, Jean-Claude Ntambara. He is the man who shot and tried to kill her.
I took part in the genocide here in Bugesera district, former Kanzenze commune. By the time the regime planned and executed the genocide, I was a police officer. And when the RPF launched the attack in 1990, the authorities began to spread the ideology of genocide.
He's a very tall man, imposing in stature, with a quiet demeanor. Very unassuming if you were to walk past him on the streets today. But he's not quite as calm as Claudette recounted her ordeal. He was visibly fidgeting, shifting in his seat. So why did he kill? Why did he harm Claudette and others?
We started the killing using firearms, grenades, with civilians using machetes and other traditional weapons. We killed too many people that day, and those who escaped were caught later and killed in some other places because we tracked them down in mountains and other hideouts, and the killing went on for many days. After we finished killing people here in Nyamata, we continued searching for fugitives in the bushes, and I found her in a place called Carrière. She was hiding in a home whose owner, a woman, called onto us and said there was Inyenzi cockroach hiding in their house. We entered the room, saw her sitting on bed, deeply wounded and covered in blood. And then I shot her in the shoulder to finish her. We had orders not to spare anyone. I thought I had killed her.
Rwanda is notable for the process of forgiveness and reconciliation that has occurred in the years since the genocide. And of course, forgiveness is one part of the story. The other part of the story is remorse. And of course, remorse and forgiveness mutually support and reinforce each other. So when you have hope that you will be forgiven, that actually encourages the development of remorse. And when a perpetrator is remorseful, that actually makes it easier to forgive them, because we are human. We are seeing these survivors reintroducing the former perpetrators to the community and reassuring all the other community members that this person is experiencing genuine and deep remorse, and we encourage the rest of the community to accept him or her as well. And then that creates the basis for reconnection and reintegration in the community.
It is a very interesting process which allows you to become human again and reflect on one's crimes. I used to blame the former leadership which forced me to commit crimes, but the healing process eventually made me acknowledge my responsibility. That's the most important thing about the healing process. And when you acknowledge your transgressions, you feel bad and get the strength to ask for forgiveness. For example, I had to face many people and ask for forgiveness, including Claudette and others. I finally was forgiven and accepted back in the society. It was a nightmare, but now that's over. Life is good. We live in harmony. We attend social gatherings together. In fact, we share everything in life, good or bad. In fact, the journey towards healing is very useful to humanity. It set you free, both the offender and the offended.
Jean-Claude was also found guilty for his crimes. He was sentenced to community work. And part of Rwanda's healing process is also looking to the future, which Dr. Alexandros Lourdes says is vital for the next generation.
So first you work on the collective healing and the personal healing, and then the capstone of that is the collaborative livelihoods. It's not just that it addresses the poverty and the hunger, but it also gives everyone new identities. The ultimate stage of healing is to start forgetting the identity of survivor and perpetrator.
I'm just now walking into the compound of my old school, and there is no sound that fills me with so much joy, so much happiness, as the sound of children in a classroom or children playing. This is evoking so many good memories.
But being back at my old school also stirred other memories. It was here that I realized how deep-seated the divisions in my country were.
One morning in 1990, we came to school and we were told by the teacher probably something that they had been asked or ordered to do, to just ask the children what ethnicity they were. So the teacher said, if you are a Tutsi, you stand on one side. If you are a Hutu, you stand on the other side. If you are a Twa, you stand on the other side. And that was quite confusing for a bunch of us. We were only 9, 10, 11 years old.
Things couldn't be more different now. The children are playing, and I look at them and I think about what my life could have been. I didn't get to grow up in my country, but they are. So what's changed in Rwanda that could suggest a better future for them?
It is transitioning. It is transitioning towards a future orientation. We are seeing this at every level of society. It is definitely a demand of the younger generation. So the university students now are children who were born just after the genocide. They grew up in the aftermath of the genocide. They grew up in this whole discussion around surviving, around forgiving, around justice, around transitional justice. So this was their childhood, and they want to move on. So they are driving this narrative towards thinking about the Rwanda of the future that is moving towards being a peaceful and developed country. The government has an ambitious agenda to turn Rwanda into a middle-income country by 2035 and a high-income country by 2050. Rwanda itself needs to position itself in the African economy and the global economy in new ways. We are definitely seeing a pivot from a Rwanda that is focusing on what happened in 1994 and before 1994 and having survived from that, to a Rwanda that is aspiring towards 2050 and working towards that objective.
But there are those who feel the country's not gone far enough. Karine Kanimba is the daughter of Paul Rusesabagina, who inspired the film Hotel Rwanda for saving hundreds of countrymen from genocide. But in 2020, he was convicted of terrorism offences in a widely criticised trial and later released.
So Rwanda is a dictatorship. The current president, Paul Kagame, has been in power for almost 30 years now. He won the election by 98%. We all understand that this is not a democratic election. People in Rwanda, when they speak out against the regime, when a journalist writes the truth, reports on people who are not doing well in the country, they end up jailed and tortured. When a person wants to propose a new solution on how to the government should run, how the country should run, they're seen as political opposition and they're jailed for doing so. And so when I talk about repressive regime, I talk about the fact that there are no freedoms in Rwanda because people are frightened.
This is something the Rwandan government refutes and says there have been huge strides in bringing people together and allowing them to talk about what happened, the genocide, in order to bring reconciliation. Yolande Makolo is the Rwandan government spokesperson.
There's a whole process that's been ongoing 10 years ago, a program called Ndumunya Rwanda, meaning I am Rwandan, where Rwandans were talking very openly about what it meant, whatever background they were from, what happened in 1994 to them, to their families. I had colleagues who were talking about their family members who were in prison for genocide or had been released, or what it meant to be a survivor, to have lost people. We were talking very openly, Rwandans all over the country were talking about who they are, what they felt about this process of reconciliation, what happened to their families, what it means to be a young Rwandan who did not participate in genocide, whose maybe the genocide was carried out in their name, but they are not associated with it at all, having to go to school with survivors. What does that mean, young people associating with each other? These are things that we've been discussing for years now.
As my trip was coming to an end, I was happy to take part in one of the activities I remembered from my childhood, community service we call Umuganda. One day every month where Rwandans come together to help clean and build their own communities. Some say a country's collective trauma begins with the healing of individuals. And it is from that individual trauma I've witnessed such strength of people being able to forgive. The healing of a country begins with individuals making peace and having the space to do so.
We need to have a dialogue. We need to have a real conversation about the truth of our history. And without these dialogues taking place, which have been prohibited by the regime, then there is no clear future, no bright future. And so my hope is that there is space for dialogue, that there is space for real truth and reconciliation, and real space for the future of Rwanda.
I do not know when I will die. Maybe it's today or tomorrow or even tonight. But I felt like if I died without forgiving him, the burden could be on my children. If I died and those hatred sentiments still lingered, we wouldn't be building the Rwanda I'd want for my children. It would be the Rwanda I grew up in. It would be of children who meet and say to one another, "Your father tried to kill my mother and she died with the wounds your father caused." I do not want my children to go through such a life. A time where people came and burned our home. A life of segregation between Hutus and Tutsis. I cannot pass that on to my children.
Children are getting an education, which is totally different from that of before the genocide. And besides, those who gave well bad influences before the genocide, I guess they're getting out of the way and leaving behind children who will grow nicely in a reconciled and unified society where people live in peace and won't have to inherit a bad legacy, which I think is fading away. So, I hope our country will be a much better place in the future.
And that is what every Rwandan hopes for. I'm still assessing my emotions, especially my journey back home, and even more so, reflecting on the stories I heard and the impressions they all made on me. And as I continue to reflect and process my homegoing, one startling realization sprang to mind. My reconciling that this place I was seeing again no longer felt like my home. But as they say, home is always where the heart is. And once again, I left a piece of mine back in the land that saw me draw in my first breath. It's a lot to process. But chief among these were thoughts of our journeys, individual and collective. How someone like Claudette, who was just a year older than me when her life was upended, could turn around and offer possibly one of the greatest gifts, forgiveness, to a man who did the unthinkable to her. How those stories and journeys from everyone we spoke to and heard from all had one major thing in common: moving on and healing. For oneself, but for those who wronged them and their families and their country. And that is where we find Rwanda 30 years on. The road has been long, but there are glimpses of hope, of strength, of resilience. The documentary Rwanda 30 Years On was presented by me, Victoria Uwamhunda, produced by Louise Clark, edited by Claire Fordham. The technical producer is Craig Boardman, and production support was by Gemma Ashman.
Leute, es wird unangenehm, denn ich muss euch einfach fragen, habt ihr euch eigentlich schon mal um eure Versicherung gekümmert? Hier ist übrigens Tara vom Podcast Tara sagt was und ich sage euch, es wird allerhöchste Zeit, Ordnung in euer Versicherungschaos zu bringen und dabei kann euch die App Clark helfen. Da arbeiten ganz viele Expertinnen, die das hauptberuflich machen, man glaubt es kaum. Und mit meinem Code TARA60, alles groß und zusammengeschrieben, könnt ihr euch sogar einen Shopping-Gutschein sichern, 60 Euro, bei zum Beispiel Amazon oder Douglas einlösbar, mit dem Code TARA60.
I'm Katia Adler from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at the tiny country of Guyana, which is the fastest growing economy in the world. But will newfound oil reserves be a windfall or their downfall? Curious? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.